You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
History isn't black and white, yet too often it's presented as such. Grey History, The French Revolution is a long-form history podcast dedicated to exploring the ambiguities and nuances of the past. From a revolution of hope and liberty to the infamous Reign of Terror, you can't understand the modern world without understanding the French Revolution. So search for the French Revolution today.
Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 16, Parsons, Bishops, and Trade. Last week, we talked about the end of the Seven Years' War with the Treaty of Paris in 1763. With the war over, American colonists began paying more attention to domestic issues. Today, I want to take a look at three of those issues that begin to define how the colonists were beginning to see their interests as separate from those of Britain. The first issue, the Parsons Cause, flared up in Virginia during the war. According to colonial law, the colonial government paid ministers, Church of England only, of course, with tax money. Because real gold and silver was so hard to come by in the colonies, and paper money varied so much in value, payments to ministers came in a more stable currency, tobacco. The most recent law of 1748, passed by the colonial legislature and approved by the King's Privy Council, permitted each minister to be paid 16,000 pounds of tobacco annually. The minister could resell it locally, smoke it, or ship it off to London. In practice, though, the burgesses paid ministers the cash equivalent of 16,000 pounds of tobacco in Virginia currency. While tobacco retained pretty good value every year, like any commodity, its value fluctuated greatly depending on supply and demand. In some years, the price was so low that the legislature had offered supplemental payments to the ministers. In 1755, though, the price of tobacco soared and the ministers would have gotten quite a benefit. The price was also high because tobacco crops came in short that year, meaning less supply. This also meant plantation owners were doing worse than in previous years. Since the House of Burgesses was run by plantation owners and not ministers, they found it quite reasonable to require the ministers to be paid that year in paper currency at 2 pence per pound of tobacco, well below market rates. For 16,000 pounds of tobacco, that would be about 133 pounds in Virginia currency, which was worth less than a British pound sterling. It was, however, a decent amount of money, about 4 times what the average working man would make in a year. The legislature wisely set the pay change for only 10 months, which meant by the time any complaints reached London and policies were overridden and returned to Virginia, the period of change would be pretty much complete. As a result, the ministers grumbled but did nothing. Then, again in 1758, tobacco prices again reached extreme highs, though this time there was no particular shortage, just high prices because of heavier demand. It should have been a good year for everyone. Even so, plantation owners saw no need to give ministers a bonus and again offered only 133 pounds in Virginia currency for the year. Since paper was depreciating even faster this year, ministers had an even worse deal than in 1755, and this new law covered 2 full years. This time the ministers appealed to the governor, who passed the buck over to London. In response, the London Privy Council sent back an opinion that essentially said, "Look, the law approved by the king guarantees the value of 16,000 pounds of tobacco. You cannot simply break that contract retroactively and pay less, especially through a law that's not approved by the king." With that ruling in hand, several ministers went to court in Virginia to get their money. Local courts, however, did not agree with the Privy Council. Several local juries, in no hurry to give extra cash to ministers, simply found for the defendants and refused to award any damages. Everyone understood that more money to all the ministers only meant higher taxes for everyone else. Also, many Virginians were not even Anglicans in the first place and objected to Anglican ministers only getting paid. Therefore, local juries were not particularly inclined to hand over large awards in court, no matter what the law said. In one celebrated case, the Reverend James Maury of Fredericksville Parish won his case. The case then proceeded to a second trial on damages. At that point, the defendant's lawyer wanted out of the case. The damages trial was a waste of time. Pay under the law should have been around £400 based on the market price of tobacco. The plaintiff had been paid £133, so anyone who knew basic math knew the damages were around £267. The defendants, however, seeing juries refusing to pay awards in other cases, decided to try their luck in contesting the damages. They hired a new young lawyer who had been practicing for less time than the case had been in dispute. Patrick Henry became a lawyer in 1760 after spending several weeks reading cases at a Virginia law office. The case had taken several years to reach this damages trial in 1763. The defendants hired Henry, hoping he could work some magic despite the facts and the law being on the plaintiff's side. The plaintiff's attorney made the damages case short and simple. He put up two witnesses attesting to the value of 16,000 pounds of tobacco in 1758. Given that value and subtracting what the ministers had already received, that was the damages. Okay, now the jury can see the math, render its decision, and we can all go to lunch. Henry, however, used a legal technique once described to me by a law professor. If the law is not on your side, pound on the facts. If the facts are not on your side, pound on the law. If neither is on your side, just pound on the table. Henry simply ignored the facts and law of the case, as they were both clearly against him. Instead, he gave a long speech to the jury, lasting several hours. Now, there are no transcripts or even detailed written records of Henry's speech, but witnesses afterwards said that Henry focused on the idea that government paid ministers to help convince the people to obey the laws of society. In this case, a minister was advocating that courts should ignore the legislative act giving him £133 for 1758. Since he was opposing the law, he should get nothing. The fact that the king also voided the law only showed that the king was acting as a tyrant and should be ignored. Henry also attacked the ministers for attempting to unjustly enrich themselves by taking so much money from the impoverished people of Virginia. Although several judges thought Henry might have committed treason for what he said about the king, they did not cut off his argument. The jury, on the other hand, was much more disposed to the argument and awarded the plaintiff exactly one penny in damages. This case made Patrick Henry a local hero and helped his new practice to grow rapidly. Aside from introducing young Patrick Henry, who will of course play much more of a role later in our story, this case also shows how colonists viewed the importance of juries in ensuring that laws were executed as the people saw fit, not as those officials in London may have wanted. It also served as an example to the British that American juries could not be trusted to enforce the law. Finally, it provides some insight into the growing American frustration about having to pay taxes to support ministers that they did not particularly like. If the Parsons case showed how much Virginians disliked excessive taxes, objected to interference from London in local affairs, and were not fans of the Church of England, you could probably multiply those sentiments several times over when it came to the colonists in New England. The Puritans, of course, founded Massachusetts for the primary purpose of getting away from the Church of England. They wanted to practice their Congregationalist form of Protestant Christianity. Now, technically, the Puritans only wanted to purify the Church of England, also called the Anglican Church, and today called the Episcopal Church. But in practical terms, Congregationalism practiced in New England was entirely separate from the Anglican Church. Leaving aside the many doctrinal differences, the one big structural difference was that they did not rely on Anglican bishops to appoint ministers. Local parishes controlled hiring ministers and just about everything else related to the local church. Originally, Massachusetts only permitted Congregationalist churches. Eventually, though, the colony had to allow the establishment of some Anglican churches. The first one, King's Chapel in Boston, was established in 1688, more than 50 years after the colony's founding. Over the years, a few more popped up around the colony, but Anglicans probably made up less than 3% of the population. In 1742, the colony even permitted money from Anglican taxpayers to go to Anglican churches rather than all church taxes going exclusively to the Congregationalist churches. The Anglican Church also had several mission churches in the colony. These were dedicated to converting the local Indians to Christianity. The reality, though, is that almost no Anglicans nor Congregationalists put much effort into missions work by the 1700s. It probably did not help the cause that early conversion and the creation of Indian praying towns ended up with the Christianized Indians being killed or forced out of their lands. That seemed to put a damper on more Indians joining such towns. In 1760, though, the Anglicans began work on Christ Church in Cambridge, right next to Harvard College. Christ Church was a mission church, seeking to bring people into the Anglican faith. But there were no Indians anywhere near the church, only good Congregationalists. While Congregationalists thought it was all well and good to convert heathens or even Catholics to Anglicanism, it was not appropriate to drag pious Congregationalists back into Anglicanism. By 1762, the colony created its own mission society for the Indians, working to convert them into the good Congregationalists' faith. Back in England, the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury opposed this and got the Privy Council in London to disallow the act in 1763. The colonists took this as an affront to their religion, which many in Massachusetts saw as a fundamental cornerstone of their society. The Anglicans back in London were preventing the Congregationalists in Massachusetts from bringing their own Indians into Christianity. Adding fire to this dispute, the Anglican minister at Christ Church, the Reverend East Apthorpe, decided to publish a pamphlet in 1763 supporting the Anglican Society's missionary work in the colony. This drew a response from Reverend Jonathan Mayhew, the Congregationalist minister of West Church in Boston, who attacked Apthorpe for his derisive comments about Congregationalist churches and claimed that Anglican ministers were in Massachusetts to, quote, spy out our liberty, end quote, and, quote, help bring us into bondage, end quote. That same year, Archbishop Thomas Secker in Canterbury published his own pamphlet, anonymously, called An Answer to Dr. Mayhew's Observations, which supported the goals of bringing more Anglicans into the colonies and attacking many of the past practices in Massachusetts. This set off another flurry of articles and pamphlets in Massachusetts as the divisions grew deeper. If you're interested in getting more into the details about this debate over bishops in Massachusetts, I have links on my website to all of the full text of all these original pamphlets, which you can view at amrevpodcast.blogspot.com. So around the same time that all these pamphlets were flying around Massachusetts, Archbishop Secker, back in London, decided that this would be a good time to foist an Anglican bishop on Massachusetts and force the colony to pay for it. He had been planning this for some time and discussed his plans with members of Parliament. The leaders in Parliament sensibly thought that this was a foolish time to throw another controversy into the debate and put off his suggestion. Despite not even bringing it to a vote, word of the attempt reached Massachusetts and set off another round of concerns about Parliament's power to get involved in colonial affairs. The people of Massachusetts and New England generally, which was almost entirely Congregationalists as well, saw Britain as not only attempting to foist more officials on the colonies that would require higher taxes, but were interfering with their basic practice of religion. Years later, John Adams wrote that the fear of the plan to install an Anglican archbishop in Massachusetts, quote, contributed as much as any other cause to arouse the attention not only of the inquiring mind, but of the common people, and urged them to close thinking on the constitutional authority of Parliament over the colonies, end quote. Now, while religion and taxes were always touchy issues, trade laws affected how most colonists made a living, either directly or indirectly. Much of New England made its livelihood from the transatlantic trade. other colonies had large trade economies as well, and much of this was quite deliberate. Britain benefited greatly from raw materials imported from the colonies. Britain did not want the colonies to develop local, self-sustaining industries and economies. Rather, it wanted colonists to supply raw materials to Britain and buy finished goods from Britain. This provided jobs for the British people and provided the government with some revenue, primarily extracted at the ports of England. Colonial trade had long been a simmering issue between London and the colonies. Although trade restrictions and customs duties had been in place for more than a century, most people traditionally ignored them. British customs agents often lived in England and collected their pay without ever even seeing the harbors that they were supposed to administer. Those who were on location often took bribes that allowed merchants to avoid most or all duties, as well as ignore restrictions on trade with other countries. Any customs agent foolish enough to try to enforce the law could find himself in court with a hostile jury forcing him to personally pay monetary damages to merchant traders. In the summer of 1760, Secretary of State William Pitt ordered colonial governors to crack down on trade with the enemy, which he saw as hampering the war effort. This was not just about tariffs going unpaid. This was more about New England ship captains engaging in trade with the same French colonies in the West Indies that the British were planning to invade. Such trade was giving direct aid and comfort to the enemy. Now, outgoing Massachusetts Governor Thomas Pownall began to see his position as a career dead end. Getting the colonists to follow any instructions from Britain seemed impossible. He left for England in June 1760 in pursuit of bigger and better jobs. Although he received an appointment to become governor of South Carolina, he never went there, instead getting elected to a seat in Parliament. You may have noticed this trend already, but royal governors often had no specific affiliation to the colony they governed. It was quite common, even the norm, for royal governors to move from one colony to another and eventually back to England. Now, New Jersey Governor Francis Bernard became the new governor of Massachusetts. Bernard decided to push Pitt's initiative to crack down on illegal trade. It probably did not hurt that the governor received a share of the proceeds of any ships seized in any smuggling. Even if Bernard had done everything else right, this highly unpopular enforcement of trade laws probably would have been enough to get the entire colony to hate him. But this was not his only misstep. In hindsight, Bernard probably made the biggest mistake almost immediately after taking office. He appointed Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson to become Chief Judge of the Massachusetts Superior Court of Judicature, the colony's highest court. Hutchinson had been Lieutenant Governor under Governor Shirley, who was his patron, and under Governor Pownall. But Pownall never really trusted Hutchinson because of Hutchinson's relationship with Shirley. Even though Pownall ended up adopting many of Shirley's policies, he always seemed to regard his predecessor as a crook and did not trust anyone associated with him. Governor Bernard probably thought he was giving a plum job to a capable man who had been number two for many years and was ready for advancement. Hutchinson came from a wealthy and prominent New England family, and improving relations with colonial leaders helped make the royal governor more effective. Hutchinson, though a capable politician, was not even a trained lawyer. More importantly, Governors Shirley and Pownall had both promised the position of chief judge to James Otis Sr., a prominent attorney who had served as the colony's attorney general and was also a member of the Council of Massachusetts. When Bernard failed to follow through on the promises of his predecessors, James Otis Jr. took Hutchinson's appointment as a personal affront to his father. Otis Jr., a lawyer in his own right, had been Advocate General of the Admiralty Court, the prosecutor for cases involving smuggling, customs, and other trade violations. Otis immediately resigned his position and began representing merchants who were being prosecuted by the colony. Overnight, Otis went from being a member of the colonial establishment to one of its most outspoken opponents. In 1761, the Massachusetts Surveyor General of Customs applied for a routine renewal of his writs of assistance. These were general warrants that gave him the right to search any warehouse or home for suspected smuggled goods. It was essentially a free pass to enter any private property and look for any evidence of a crime, even without any suspicion that he would find anything. Otis opposed these writs in compelling arguments discussing the natural rights of man, the tyranny and oppressive nature of such warrants, and how it was destroying their common law rights. His opposition received considerable publicity and made him a hero within the colony. It was enough for Chief Judge Hutchinson to write back to London for confirmation that such writs were legal. After receiving such confirmation, he issued the writs. The people of Massachusetts, however, agreed with the arguments Otis had presented in opposition. Often goaded by merchants seeking to protect their goods, mobs formed to prevent customs officials from exercising these warrants. In an era where there were no police to back up officials, and with no military around, customs officials had no choice but to back down. This issue actually cooled off the following year, in 1762, when the British captured Martinique and most of the other French colonies in the Caribbean. Suddenly, it became perfectly legal for merchants to trade with these now British colonies, and the issue went onto the back burner. But the political lines had been drawn, and would return in later years. Colonists were showing that they would openly defy laws that they considered unjust or even simply against their interests. British officials also seemed to give colonists the confidence that if they stood up to something, officials in London would usually back down. Next week, we'll discuss the one other big colonial issue, Western lands, which moves back to the top of the list as most of the major Indian tribes unite against the flow of British colonists threatening their land.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.